Tight for details. VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is John Russell.
The ancient bones of a distant ancestor of the modern giraffe are offering scientists evidence about why the animal's long neck developed. Scientists say these fossils, which were discovered in China, suggest a long neck was helpful for competitions between males. Researchers recently described the fossils, including a thick skull, or bones of the head, and strong neck bones. They belonged to an early member of the giraffe family called Discocarix shiager. The creature lived about 17 million years ago in the Xinjiang area in northwestern China. Discocarix's solidly built skull and strong neck bones were well adapted to high-speed head-to-head crashes. They were like competitions seen among males of some mammal species for female mates, the researchers said. They explained that Discocarix had the most complex neck bones of any mammal. This was the case for joints between the head and neck, as well as between the individual neck bones. Discocarix means disc horn, while shiager is a single-horned creature in traditional Chinese stories. Discocarix's skull had a large round-shaped and thick bone structure known as ossicone. That is the name for the horn-like objects on the top of giraffes' heads. Shiqi Wang, lead writer of the study published in Science, said ossicones, like horns and antlers, usually serve as weapons for males fighting for mates. Study co-writer Jean Meng said the traditional idea about why modern giraffes have such long necks is that long necks are useful for eating tree leaves. Discocarix most likely ate grasses, Meng explained. Meng added, "This new finding shows that, in the giraffe family, members do different things in their early evolution. The new species represents an extreme example in which the neck becomes very thick to absorb the power and impact from powerful headbutting." Another idea about giraffe neck evolution, one supported by Discocarix's bone structure, is that neck lengthening was driven by behavior shown in competition for mates, like the necking seen in giraffes today. In such competitions, males violently strike each other with their necks. Longer-necked males often win these fights. If a male giraffe has a shorter neck, then the female may refuse the mating request of the male, Wang said. Neck lengthening, or elongation, independently evolved among several animal groups hundreds of millions of years ago. Discocarix, the researchers said, may offer information about the early developments of giraffe neck lengthening that took place over millions of years. Discocarix, however, took a different evolutionary path specialized for headbutting. It is not considered a direct ancestor of today's giraffe, but rather a side development of the giraffe family. The modern giraffe, found in Africa south of the Sahara Desert, is the world's tallest living land animal. Males can grow up to 5.5 meters tall, and females up to 4.3 meters tall. A giraffe's neck, stretching about 1.8 meters, has just 7 neck bones like other mammals. Discocarex lived in open grasslands with small groups of trees during a time known as the Miocene period. It lived alongside ancient elephants, rhinos, pigs, deer, and horses. Predators at the time included saber-toothed cats, hyenas, and a member of a mammalian group called dog bears, a creature as big as a modern polar bear. I'm John Russell.
Ogbontolawa Marigi worked deep in a forest in Nigeria, a country on the western coast of Africa. He is a logger who cuts down trees using an axe and a machete. The forest where he worked is in the Ondo state in southwest Nigeria. But many trees in that forest have been lost to illegal logging. The 61-year-old father of two told Reuters that he could cut down over 15 trees anywhere in the forest, but he would be lucky to find two. During the time of our forefathers, we had big trees, but sadly what we have now are just small trees, and we don't even allow them to mature before we cut them, Marigi said. After cutting down the trees, Marigi put markers on them to let other loggers know that he is the owner. The cut-down trees or logs are then transported by waterways and rivers to Nigeria's most populated city, Lagos. Trees in Nigeria are cut down to open land for farming or to feed the energy demand of a growing population. From 2001 to 2021, Nigeria has lost 1.14 million hectares of tree cover. Global Forest Watch provides data and follows the state of the forests. The organization says that the 11% decrease in tree cover in Nigeria equals the emissions of 587 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. President Muhammadu Buhari spoke at a recent UN meeting on biodiversity in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. He said that Nigeria has provided money to help regrow the country's forests, but that may not be enough as the country loses forests even more quickly. Femi Obaden is the director of forest management for Ondo State's Agriculture Ministry. He said, "Protecting the forest means protecting ourselves. When we destroy the forest, we destroy humanity." I'm Jill Robbins.
As a young man in one of Washington, D.C.'s toughest neighborhoods, Rodney Stotts had little to live for. His father had been murdered. His mother was addicted to drugs. Many of his friends were dead from gun violence. And he expected to end up dead or in jail. But then, in 1992, an environmental program changed his life. In his new book, Bird Brother, The 51-year-old writes about the healing power of wildlife that took him from drug dealer to wildlife expert. Stotts told the Reuters news agency, "I went from flipping birds, a street term for selling cocaine, to flying birds, and the destruction that I used to cause in that life, I'm just trying to make up for it." He said he hopes to inspire others to take comfort in nature. The environmental program was created by filmmaker and conservationist Bob Nixon. Nixon left Hollywood and moved to Washington, D.C. to start Earth Conservation Corps. Its first goal was to clean the Anacostia River. At that time, the organization called it the most polluted river in America. It says the river flows through communities of color with Washington's highest unemployment and crime rates. Nixon hired 9 young helpers, including Stotts, from a nearby public housing community. For the next several years, Stotts spent his days cleaning up the river. He also learned about birds of prey. The group helped bring bald eagles back to the city. Over time, Stotts found himself drawn more toward caring for birds than selling drugs. Stotts said the more he moved away from drugs, the happier he seemed to get. Along the way, Stotts also wanted to become a master falconer. Becoming a master falconer requires 2 main steps: passing a state test and finding a sponsor. The sponsor teaches the important lessons of falconry, the ethics of the sport, how to identify, trap, and care for the birds, and how to release them back into the wild. However, many possible sponsors did not take him seriously. Stotts said one man told him over the phone, "You sound like you're a black guy." Stotts said that he was. The man then told Stotts, "Black people don't fly birds, they eat them." Eventually, he found a sponsor, and last June, he officially became a master falconer. 30 years after their first meeting, Stotts and Nixon are passing their knowledge to the next generation. On a recent May evening, Stotts talked with young people in the Capital Guardian Youth Challenge Academy. It is a program for young school dropouts working to help injured birds. Stotts told them to turn off their phones and just sit and listen to the water. He used an old saying. "Stop and smell the roses," he told them. Stop, actually stop and smell them. I'm Ana Mateo.
Different ships have used autonomous sailing technology to complete trips across world oceans for the first time. One of the projects involved the Mayflower Autonomous Ship. It is a completely autonomous ocean research ship powered by artificial intelligence technology. The Mayflower recently completed a 5-week trip across the Atlantic Ocean without any human crew members. It launched from the British port of Plymouth on April 27th and arrived in the eastern Canadian city of Halifax on June 5th. The 15-meter Mayflower is named after a ship that carried a group of European settlers from Plymouth to North America more than 400 years ago. That famous trip in 1620 prepared the way for Britain's colonization of what Europeans called the New World. The Mayflower autonomous ship is operated by ocean research group Promare and American technology company IBM. Rob High is an IBM executive who helped lead the Mayflower project. He told the Associated Press that the ship's autonomous technology system worked perfectly during its trip across the Atlantic. He added, however, that mechanically we did run into problems. The Mayflower experienced mechanical issues on its latest trip, as well as an earlier attempt to cross the Atlantic. The first attempt, in June 2021, was canceled after a minor mechanical issue forced the ship to return to Plymouth. Then, during the latest trip, a problem with the ship's power system led project organizers to send the ship to Portugal's Azores Islands in the mid-Atlantic. A team member was flown to the area to perform emergency repairs. More troubles came in late May when the Mayflower developed another power issue. That problem was also repaired, but the team decided to send the ship on a new path to Halifax. This is because the Canadian port was closer than its planned target in the northeastern state of Virginia. Experts say AI software is getting much better at helping self-sailing ships understand their surroundings and pilot themselves. But most autonomous systems cannot repair themselves when mechanical hardware fails. The Mayflower is equipped with instruments designed to measure the health of ocean waters. Promare and IBM hope it will be the first in a new generation of crewless ocean traveling machines. They say such ships could be used to explore parts of oceans that are too difficult or dangerous for people to reach. In another demonstration of the technology, the owners of a large tanker say the ship recently sailed by itself for more than 10,000 kilometers across the Pacific Ocean. That ship, designed to transport natural gas, is operated by South Korea's SK Shipping. The tanker, called Prism Courage, is equipped with an autonomous navigation system developed by Hyundai-owned technology company Avicus. The company announced in a statement that the 300-meter-long ship successfully used its autonomous sailing system during about half of a 20,000-kilometer trans-Pacific trip. The tanker left the port city of Freeport, Texas, on May 1st. It arrived at a port on South Korea's southwest coast on June 2nd. During the trip, Prism Courage's autonomous navigation system recognized the presence of nearby ships to avoid crashes more than 100 times, Avicus said. In addition, the autonomous system is designed to choose the most ideal travel paths. This system resulted in a 7% improvement in fuel efficiency, while reducing gas emissions by about 5%, the company said. Avicus said it believes autonomous navigation technology can help solve worker shortages in the shipping industry. It can also reduce pollutants and improve safety by completely removing the possibility of human errors. The company said it plans to keep developing the technology for large transport ships as well as for smaller pleasure boats. I'm Brian Lynn.
Today, we visit a national park that stretches across two southern U.S. states, Tennessee and North Carolina, and two mountain ranges, the Blue Ridge and the Appalachian. The area is known for its wildflowers, autumn colors, waterfalls, and black bears. It is also known for the blue-colored mist that hangs above mountain peaks and valleys. It looks like smoke and gave the area its name. Today, we are exploring the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. We are hardly alone on our journey. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park gets more visitors than any other.
Starting in the 1920s, local citizens began working to protect the land. Ann Davis moved to Knoxville, Tennessee in 1915. She soon came to love the Great Smoky Mountains. In 1923, Davis visited some of the national parks in the western United States. She proposed creation of a national park to protect the Smokies after she returned home. Ann Davis entered politics to help push the idea. In 1925, she became the first female from her county to serve in the Tennessee State House of Representatives. She proposed a bill to permit the purchase of more than 30,000 hectares of land from the Little River Lumber Company. That was the first huge purchase of land used to create the national park. In 1934, Tennessee and North Carolina gave the federal government more than 300,000 hectares of land for the park. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park was established on June 15, 1934. But the official dedication did not take place until 1940, when President Franklin Roosevelt spoke at a ceremony within the park. The ceremony took place at the Rockefeller Monument, on the border between the two states that provided the land. Roosevelt said that day, "It is good and right that we should conserve these mountain heights of the old frontier for the benefit of the American people."
Most years, around 9 million people visit the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It is the largest area of protected land east of the Rocky Mountains, and it is one of the few national parks that is free to enter. The park has over 1,000 kilometers of trails, more than 110 kilometers of the world-famous Appalachian Trail cuts through the Smokies. So, you might share the trail with a hiker in the middle of a months-long walk from Georgia all the way north to Maine. Visitors also share the park with a large population of black bears. The park is one of the biggest protected areas in the eastern U.S. where wild black bears live. Black bears once roamed a huge part of North America, but the populations suffered because of habitat loss. Scientists say around 1,500 black bears live in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Park officials work hard to protect them and warn visitors not to get close to bears or leave behind trash that would harm the bears.
Many visitors come to the park to view wildlife. One of the most popular places to do so is in an area called Cades Cove. Here, visitors can see white-tailed deer, the dog-like coyote, turkeys, and yes, black bears. Cades Cove is a valley. It has a long and rich history. The Cherokee Indians used to hunt there. The first European settlers arrived in the early 1800s. In the 1830s, around 270 people lived in Cades Cove. Today, many kinds of historic buildings and structures remain in the valley, including log houses, barns, churches, and a working mill. Cades Cove is also an excellent place to view wildflowers. The park is famous for its wildflower diversity. Within the park are more than 1,500 kinds of flowers, more than any other national park in the country. Another famous spot in the Great Smoky Mountains is Clingman's Dome. It is the highest point within the park. At the top of the 2,024-meter-tall mountain is an observation tower. It offers viewers a 360-degree view of the Smokies and surrounding areas.
Unfortunately, the park has faced air pollution problems. The pollution harms the views atop Clingman's Dome and other scenic spots in the park. The Cherokee Indians who lived in the area used to call these mountains Shakonaji, which means place of the blue smoke. Today, the blue-gray smoke that surrounds the mountains is no longer pure. Some of it is just air pollution. Most comes from electric power centers and cars. The pollution damages native plants and water streams. It also affects the views from the scenic overlooks. It can make the mountain colors appear less bright and beautiful. The National Park Service suggests that visitors by car consider using public transportation from the city of Gatlinburg, Tennessee. A trolley car takes visitors to many stops within the park. The millions of visitors to this beautiful part of America have a special responsibility to preserve the land that many worked so hard to protect. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.